welcome back to A Book A Day podcast. In the previous episode, I was discussing Pankaj Mishra's book, Temptations of the West. And in the previous episode, I talked about what Pankaj Mishra talked about when he visited Pakistan, the kind of experiences he had there, and of course, the underlying social and political themes there. In today's episode, what I'll do is, I will turn to the chapter on Afghanistan, and I'll narrate a few passages from there. What he saw there, what was going on in Afghanistan back then, and you will be able to draw comparisons in Afghanistan when the Taliban was there in government and when Taliban was not there. And you can then again compare that with today's situation when once again the Taliban, they are back in the government. And of course, all the behind the scenes, all the stuff that was going on, whether it was about communism or American imperialism, the war, the Taliban, the Islamic Jihad, the warlords, all of that. So, let me start narrating a few passages from the book, and I hope you'll enjoy the journey, and you'll get to know a lot more about Afghanistan. So, here we go. Afghanistan, communists, mullahs, and warlords. Much of Kabul is built of mud, and when it rained before the Christmas of 2004, relieving a long and severe drought, the whole city seemed to melt. The piles of slush on its unpaved lanes rose, as though in a slow-moving tide, until they spattered everything. The big white land cruisers of aid agencies and Afghan ministers, the beat-up yellow taxis, the bombed-out palaces of western Kabul, and the bullet-pocket huts on steep hills, the fortified foreign embassies and UN offices, and even the high billboards exhorting Afghans in idiosyncratic English to national reconciliation and peace. Despite the rain and the cold, the bazaars were crowded. Shopkeepers representing almost all of Afghanistan's ethnic groups, Pashtuns, Tajiks, Hazaras, Uzbeks, and Turkmens, hawked oranges, carpets, Chinese-made windbreakers, and electronic goods, while beggars, mostly disabled children and widows in burqas, squatted beside the sewers and tugged at the white trousers of passing men. Thousands of refugee families huddled around small bonfires at the abandoned Soviet embassy, amid bomb-shattered slabs of concrete and open manholes. It was strange to see no white faces in these crowds. Even in the modern part of Kabul, where thousands of Europeans and Americans live, mostly soldiers, diplomats, and aid workers and businessmen, the streets were empty. Afghan guards with Kalashnikovs stood in front of iron gates set in high concrete walls topped with barbed wire. The gates occasionally opened to reveal a new or renovated mansion and to release or admit a land cruiser with tinted windows. To be a foreigner in Afghanistan, it seemed, is to move from one protected enclave to another. An Indian journalist I met soon after arriving in Kabul that December told me that security had deteriorated soon after the presidential election in October, which the Taliban had failed to disrupt and which Hamid Karzai had won convincingly. That same month, a suicide bomber, a apparently from the Taliban, had killed an American woman and injured three European soldiers at a shopping district a few meters away from my hotel. The Indian journalist seemed lonely, frustrated by the restrictions on both his travel and social life. For some months now, he had wished to set up an FCC, that is, Foreign Correspondents Club in Kabul, on the lines of one in Hong Kong. One cold, rainy evening, I traveled to his home with one of the foreign journalists he had invited to join the club. When we arrived, we found several other potential members already there. As usual, there was no power. A diesel generator spluttered outside the journalist's fortress-like home, one of the thousands running simultaneously in Kabul, giving to the city its characteristic low rumble. Inside, Afghan servants, chauffeurs, and bodyguards, part of the new service economy of Kabul, bustled around, replenishing bowls of dried fruits. The journalist opened a case full of alcohol. Smuggled bottles gleamed wickedly in the dim, flickering light. Sipping Scotch whiskey and German beer, the journalists loudly exchanged local gossip I would hear repeatedly in the next few days from Afghans, about kickbacks from an Afghan mobile phone operator to a cabinet minister, and about $1 million allegedly missing from the coffers of Ariana, the Afghan national airline. They speculated about whether Karzai would be confident enough to exclude the most corrupt and powerful warlords, Defense Minister Mohammad Fahim and his deputy Abdul Rashid Dostum, from his new cabinet. There were complaints about extravagant UN agencies and NGOs pushing up rents in Kabul up to $3,000 for a dingy two-bedroom apartment. About the arrogant employees of the American company DynCorp who worked as Karzai's bodyguards. The Indian journalist abruptly called for silence and read out what he said was a draft constitution adopted from the FCC in Hong Kong. He then asked for suggestions. As it turned out, almost every idea proposed that evening ran into an obstacle. The club needed a permanent home, but this seemed possible only when rents in Kabul were less extortionate. High-paying corporate members? Perhaps when there were many more multinational corporations in Afghanistan. Honorary memberships for such visiting foreign dignitaries as Dick Cheney or the powerful US ambassador to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad? Possibly, maybe, once the American embassy had become more accessible. Even a bar, indispensable to foreign correspondent clubs, seemed unobtainable. Seeking official permission for the consumption of alcohol in Kabul could only cause offense in what was still a deeply religious and conservative country. Returning to my hotel late that night, past the sandbagged, barbed wire-topped compounds of foreign embassies and UN offices, I felt sorry for the journalist. He had seemed right to argue, as his cherished project foundered, that Kabul had advanced greatly since the collapse of the Taliban, and that with its new 1 million-strong population of repatriated refugees, many of them rich people who had spent decades in liberal societies, it was poised for a social revolution. Earlier that evening, I had seen two Afghan girls at a pizza parlor. They wore tight blue jeans, their faces were uncovered, and they sipped Pepsi Cola as they watched American women playing softball on ESPN. They would have been an unthinkable sight in the Taliban-ruled Afghanistan I had visited in early 2001. Almost 4 years later, Kabul was full of such surprises. New walled-off villas with mock Palladian facades, Well-stocked supermarkets, internet cafes, beauty parlors, restaurants, and stores selling DVDs of Bollywood as well as pornographic films. Sitting in one of Kabul's great traffic jams caused by the land cruisers, surrounded by the vivacious banter of Afghanistan's new radio stations and children hawking newspapers, I felt as if I was in a small Indian city among people prospering under the globalized economy. In brightly lit and heated offices, diplomats, NGO workers, and government officials radiated optimism as they offered facts and figures attesting to progress in Afghanistan. The first ever presidential elections in the country had been successfully conducted without any major disruptions. 3 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan and Iran had expressed their confidence in their homeland by returning to it. More than 3 million children had been enrolled in schools as compared with 900,000 under the Taliban. The 8,000 strong International Security Assistance Force under NATO command was beginning to cover regions beyond Kabul. A human rights commission had been established. The $4.4 billion pledged by international donors in Tokyo in 2002 for Afghanistan was coming in, albeit slowly. There was finally a tarmac road stretching from Kabul to Kandahar, 300 miles away to the south. More roads linking major Afghan cities were being constructed and renovated. Small civil military provincial reconstruction teams, which repaired schools and roads and were run by the United Kingdom, Germany, and the Netherlands, existed in the northern provinces and were expected to cover the entire country by 2007. Japan was at the forefront of the DDR, Demobilization, Disarmament, and Reintegration Program, targeting warlord armies, and had disarmed about 25,000 of the more than 150,000 fighters in private militias. The US was creating the Afghan National Army with 10,000 soldiers already trained. The US and Germany had trained 18,000 police officers. The UK was leading anti-narcotics efforts. The Italians were reforming the judiciary. To hear this litany of efforts was to feel the words international community, which Afghans commonly used, acquire a moral dimension in Afghanistan. With one of the lowest life expectancies and the highest infant mortality rates in the world, Afghanistan seemed to need all the help it could get. But 3 years after the US brought together several nations to rebuild Afghanistan, many Afghans tended to blame rather than praise that international community. Where was much of the money for reconstruction going? They asked, pointing to the land cruisers and the high-rent houses and offices of the expatriate community. Disarmament was a failure and would remain so until there was better security and rule of law in the country. Most militia fighters had simply concealed their best weapons and turned in those that were old and ineffective. The new Afghan army was already afflicted with desertions. There was no comprehensive plan to house and feed the millions of repatriated refugees. And though Afghans had turned out enthusiastically for their first ever direct elections, they were disappointed to see US-backed warlords still ruling much of the country. One evening, early in my time in Afghanistan, I went to see Dr. Masuda Jalal. In October 2004, she had been in the news as the lone female candidate in the presidential elections. She had got only 1.2% of the votes cast as compared to 55.4% of Karzai. But the very fact that a woman could stand for high office hinted at the immensity of the changes occurring in Afghanistan. So it was disconcerting when Dr. Jalal, sitting in a very cold, dark room and speaking in slow, precise English, denounced the elections and the registration process preceding it as a fraud perpetrated upon Afghans. Largely a show put on by the US government to impress American voters in the year of presidential elections. The international community, Dr. Jalal kept saying, believed in quantity, statistics about elections and registration processes, but was indifferent to quality. The elections had not been free and fair. Many people had registered more than once, she claimed, and voted several times. Often, men with guns had forced people to vote for Karzai. They had also tried to intimidate Dr. Jalal herself during her election campaign. Western nations, she said, had not given her a single dollar while pouring millions into Karzai's campaign. Worse, they had forgotten about women's rights, which Laura Bush and Cherry Blair had so ardently embraced in late 2001 and which were trampled upon daily across Afghanistan by men hired by the United States in its war on terror. Educated women like herself were not allowed to participate in political decision-making. Karzai's cabinet was dominated by corrupt warlords and had hardly any qualified people. People with the training and experience, she explained, to translate Western concepts of democracy into Afghan terms. As with other Afghans I had met, I felt unable to assess much of what she said. Given that there were only 250 international monitors for the elections in Afghanistan, caution does seem necessary when considering claims that 10.5 million people registered to vote and that 70% of them actually voted in October 2004. However, the scale of Karzai's victory suggests that a better organized election would have had the same overall result. It seemed to me that the election, though flawed, had been a positive step. As it turned out, within a few weeks, Dr. Jalal was appointed as Minister in charge of Women's Affairs. It again occurred to me that in places like Afghanistan, outsiders like myself bring their own assumptions of what constitutes progress and risk being limited by them. But to know, as the days passed and I traveled around Afghanistan, that the new mansions with the architectural adventurousness of Los Angeles belonged to corrupt government officials, often built upon land stolen from poor Afghans. To learn that the provincial governor, who spoke fluently of peace, reconstruction, international community, and poppy eradication, was a drug lord. To find out that the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, RAWA, which was briefly famous in the West for highlighting the Taliban's harsh treatment of women, was too fearful of radical Islamists to announce its presence in Kabul. To know all this was to begin to have a different sense of the change that had come to Afghanistan in the last 3 years. It was also to realize that, like the millions suffering from contaminated water, power and housing shortages, warlords and diseases, a club for foreign journalists would have to wait for better days. Few countries in modern times have had to wait for better days as long as Afghanistan. A bright future seemed imminent in late 2001 when the United States overthrew the Taliban regime, but the past seems hard to shake off in Afghanistan, and no events more so than the Soviet invasion of the country in 1979 and the American decision to help radical Islamists wage a jihad against Soviet communism. In the decades before the Soviet invasion, Afghanistan had been slowly making its own way into the modern world. It is hard to imagine now, but for students at Kabul University, 1968 was no less hectic a year than it was for students at Columbia, Berkeley, Oxford, and the Sorbonne. A king, Muhammad Zahir Shah, had been presiding over the many ethnic and tribal enclaves of Afghanistan since 1933. but he knew enough of the world elsewhere to attempt cautiously a few liberal reforms in his capital city, Kabul. The university was set up in 1946, a liberal constitution was introduced in 1964, the press was technically free, women ran for public office in 1965. By the 1960s, many students and teachers had traveled abroad, and new ideas about how to organize the state and society had come to the sons of peasants and nomads and artisans from their foreign or foreign-educated teachers. In the somewhat rarefied world of modernizing Kabul, where women were allowed to appear without the veil in 1959, communism and radical Islam attracted almost an equal number of believers. To these impatient men, the great Afghan countryside with its antique ways appeared ready for revolution. It was from this fledgling intelligentsia in Kabul that almost all of the crucial political figures of the next three decades emerged. Less than 5 years after 1968, King Zahir Shah was deposed in a military coup by his cousin, the ambitious former Prime Minister Muhammad Daud. Daud initially sought help from the communists, whose influence in the army and bureaucracy had grown rapidly since the 1960s. Together, they went after the radical Islamists, many of whom were imprisoned or murdered for ideological reasons. But when Daud, wary of the increasing power of the communists, tried to get rid of them, he was in turn overthrown and killed. In April 1978, the communists themselves divided confusingly into two factions, Khalq and Parcham, that roughly corresponded to the rural-urban divide in Afghanistan, assumed full control of the government in Kabul, and in their hurry to eliminate all potential opposition to their program of land redistribution and indoctrination, an attempt really to create a communist society virtually overnight, they effectively inaugurated the brutalization and destruction of Afghanistan. Within just a few months, 12,000 people, considered to be anti-communist, many of them members of the country's educated elite, were killed in Kabul alone. Thousands more were murdered in the countryside. Thousands of families began to leave the country for Pakistan and Iran. A significant number of radical Islamists of Kabul University were already in exile in Pakistan by 1978. Some of them had even started a low-intensity guerrilla war against the communist government. Several army garrisons across the country mutinied, and people in the villages, culturally very remote from Kabul, began many separate jihads against the communist regime. In 2001, in Peshawar, I met Anwar, whose father and uncle were among the earliest Afghans to take up arms against the communists. Neither were Islamists. Anwar's father, a farmer, lived in a village north of Kabul near the border with what is now Tajikistan. Although a devout Muslim, he knew little about the modern ideologies of Islam that had traveled to Kabul University from Egypt, Pakistan, and Iran. It was Anwar's uncle, an officer in Zahir Shah's finance ministry in Kabul, who was a bit more in touch with them. He was friendly with Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, then one of the prominent radical Islamists at Kabul University. Initially, the Russians were busy consolidating the communist hold over Kabul and securing the country's main highways, and seemed very far from rural Afghanistan, which in any case had had relative autonomy from the government in the capital city for years. But later, with the aggressive campaigns of land reforms and Marxist indoctrination emanating from Kabul, resistance built up swiftly throughout the country. Anwar's father and uncle joined one of the Mujahideen groups that, though equipped only with 0.303 Lee Enfield rifles, managed to keep their region free of communist influence. Then, in December 1979, the Soviet army entered the Afghanistan in order to protect the communist revolution, which was being threatened by factional fighting among Afghan communists and rebellions by the army. And the position of Anwar's family became more precarious. In 1983, Russian planes bombed the villages where Anwar and his relatives lived. In retaliation for attacks on Afghan army convoys by the Mujahideen. Although Anwar's father and uncle stayed to fight and to look after the animals and fields, there was no choice for many of the women and children but to leave. Anwar, 7 years old at the time, couldn't recall too many details of the long walk that took him and his mother and young brother to Pakistan. He did remember that it was very cold. There was snow on the ground and on the hills, and Anwar and his family walked all day, resting at night in the roadside mosques. The 350-mile-long road to Pakistan was busy with thousands of refugees, but they had to avoid moving in large groups, which would attract fire from the Russian helicopters buzzing ominously overhead. They also had to stay as close as possible to the main road, for there were mines in the fields and on the dirt tracks, tiny butterfly mines that floated down from the helicopters and then lay in wait for unmindful children and animals. I still heard about the mines when I traveled in the spring of 2001 on the road that links Kabul to Pakistan through Nangarhar province. The land seemed vacant, and the stubborn bareness of rock and desert was relieved only occasionally by a green field and a black-tented encampment of nomads. This was the land that was reclaimed for cultivation with Soviet assistance in the days of Zahir Shah, and orchards and fields watered by broad canals sprang up. In a half-abandoned village, rusty padlocks hanging from the doors into long mud walls, an old Afghan was startled when I mentioned that time. Rasool had been in his late teens then, had known some of the prosperity that came to the region, could even, with some prompting by me, remember the white men, Russian experts, traveling through the fields. Unlike Anwar's father and uncle, Rasool wasn't a Mujahideen. He hadn't revolted against the Russians or the communists. He had been content to tend his land. The jihad had almost bypassed him, and he had known hard times only when, sometime in the mid-1980s, Russian planes bombed the canals that brought water to his land. There had been another recovery after the Russian army withdrew in 1989, when white men, this time from the UN, came and supervised the repair of the canals. By then, the local Mujahideen commanders were in charge. They taxed all the traffic on the roads and took over the land that had once belonged to the Afghan state, forcing the farmers to grow high-yield poppy. There was no point in Rasool defying the commanders. He wouldn't have got cash credit from the traders in the town for anything other than opium. Not that poppy growing had improved his circumstances. It was the Mujahideen commanders who had grown very rich from converting the poppy into heroin and then smuggling it across to Iran and Pakistan. And then suddenly, before Rasool had even heard of the Taliban, its young soldiers arrived from the southern provinces, banished the Mujahideen commanders and claimed the checkpoints. They supervised and profited from the drug business until 1999, when they abruptly banned the cultivation of poppy, leaving most farmers with no sources of livelihood and the option only of migrating to Pakistan. Rasool still lived in the vast, now arid land, enduring in just 3 decades a whole fruitless cycle of Afghan history. The long reign of Zahir Shah was no more than a faint memory. All the slow, steady work of previous generations was cancelled out. Afghanistan was even further away from its tryst with the modern world. So this was today's reading, where we read the excerpts from the book where Pankaj Mishra was traveling in Afghanistan. In the next episode, we'll cover the part when he travels in India and tries to understand its socio-political dynamics. So stay with me, don't forget to follow and keep sharing your feedback with me. That really helps. So thank you once again for listening. Thank you.